Rennie Golden is a professor of criminal justice, sociology, and social work at Northeastern Illinois University. Was, she says, until recently?
Right.
Okay. But besides being a scholar, she is also a published poet. And I think it's that particular combination of qualifications that makes War on the Family such a powerful book. I didn't know much of anything about the subject of either women in prison or mothers in prison when I opened this book, and I was just blown away by it. On the scholarly side, both the factual information and the analysis of it are completely devastating. But I find that often the academic treatments of a subject will just intellectualize it in a way that actually prevents the reader from having any kind of emotional response to it. And that's where I think Rennie's sensibility as a poet comes in. The fact that she lets these women and their children tell their own stories in their own voices gives this book real emotional power and credibility that makes it twice as devastating as just analysis alone. The real accomplishment here is that Rennie isn't just preaching to the choir in this book. She's found a way to talk about a subject that most people don't know anything about and don't really want to think about in a way that anyone can understand and be moved by. So now I am just going to step out of her way and let her present her material to you directly. So please welcome Rennie Golden to Women in Prison.
Well, I would like to introduce Winona Thompson, who will be speaking with me tonight. And in fact, I see myself as somebody who's going to try to set a framework for talking about the lives of mothers who are incarcerated and the lives of their children. But I promise you, it's Winona who's going to help you really understand it. Winona is the director of Girl Talk, and it is a program at Cook County Jail that works with young women to try to help them not have to go through what she went through. And it's a program, as is true for so many not-for-profits, so many programs geared in an adversarial way for young people. It's a program that's continually trying to find funds. So she struggles with that while trying to take care of her own kids. So she will be speaking with me. I think the way we're going to do it is I'm going to try to start this framework, and then Winona's going to try to tell you what the social cost of these political, economic decisions are. One of the people who helped me begin this... Michelle. Sorry.
Surprise!
I remember this guy.
Yeah, it's bigger.
Michelle has done a tremendous amount of research on HIV, on
women,
what
women
happened
kids.
To women in terms of pregnancy. I mean, she's one of the activists who's done wonderful research work. So... I've written two books about children, and the research has taught me what a moral abyss America is in. Because if the way we treat the elderly and children is an indice of who we are as a people, we are in deep trouble. I think that as we looked at New Orleans, people understood ahead of time, but we're once again reminded of the mythologies about the lack of poverty in this country. What we were taught is that if you're poor in America, you're on your own. And what I learned in writing a book about the child welfare system and now writing this book about what happens to the children of imprisoned and incarcerated mothers, is that these children are cut loose. They're expendable. They're part of the social wash. Children who are poor in America are drowning. Louisiana was one expression of watching people drown and being allowed, there being social permission for them not to be cared for. But a more invisible population are poor children everywhere. So I say this because the United States has, in terms of industrial nations, it has one of the highest suicide rates. 50% of children who commit suicide under the age of 18 do so in the United States. We have the highest poverty rate for children of any industrialized nation in the world. 75% of child murders take place in the United States in terms of the industrial nations. There is one country besides Somalia, and Somalia isn't even an official nation because of wars that are going on. There's one country that has refused to sign the UN Charter on the rights of children, and it's the United States. The situation for children, especially poor children in America, is grave. But there is this population of children who are even more invisible than the poor, quote, in general. And it is the children of imprisoned mothers. Since 1991, there are 500,000 more children who have had parents incarcerated. And that, of course, is because of the rage of incarceration in general. A 300% increase overall, but in terms of women, in the last 20 years, there's been a 400% increase in the incarceration of women. Of those women, 70 to 75% are mothers. And of those women, 90% have committed nonviolent crime. In many cases, we're talking about 5 grams of crack. If I were to draw a gram, it would be a small dot here. We're talking about 5 grams of crack, for which they're going to do 4 to 5 years. If they're addicted, and they're picked up a second time, we're talking about, I think it's something like 6 to 15. And a third time, I mean, they're just doing hard time. So you can embezzle $1 million and not get the kind of time that these women will. Or if you're from Lake Forest or Winnetka and you can afford powder cocaine, you'll probably get probation. Or if you have 500 grams, you might get 4 years. So there's a differential in terms of a lot of Northeastern people already know this thing about the differential between powder and crack. But I'm suggesting that 80% of the women who are going to prison are going for some drug-related crime. There's a study by a University of Chicago researcher that shows that 1/3 of the women going to jail and prison in Illinois, 1/3 are going for property crime. And of those property crimes, do you know what the majority are? The majority are for writing $150 bad checks. That's what they're going to prison for. 44% of the rest are going for some drug-related crime. Again, we're talking about nonviolent crimes, and we're talking about these women are going to prison, and they're not even asked in classification what's going to happen to their kids. Kids are just cut asunder to float in the toxicity that their neighborhoods have become. So children are drowning in America already. Louisiana was just one expression of it. Do you know what the average salary in most of the parishes in New Orleans was? It was $8,000 a year. So way before the flood, there was trouble. But it's invisible. But even more tragic, it seems to me, than just what it means to be poor in America, is what it means to be the child of a mother who's imprisoned. To say nothing of what it's like to be a woman who's gone through prison. In both cases, the mother and the child are stigmatized. And that stigma is not a mark you can see, but it's a deep wound. And trauma is something that we simply can't see. The body is walking around, but the spirit has been so wounded, in some cases, you know, people can't recover. So post-traumatic stress syndrome is something we know about when we talk about Iraq or Vietnam, but we don't know that there are children walking around with this. Anything can trigger their terror because they've experienced terror. And that trauma is something that the mother carries because of the stigma of her going to prison and that her children have. It's inscripted on their bodies, on their small bodies. I think it's something like over 65% of the children of mothers who have been imprisoned are under 11. So we're talking about small children whose mother has been taken, and the question is what happens to them. In a lot of cases, the state takes them. And if it's two or three children, they are never placed together. They lose their mother and they lose each other. They're placed in foster care, but separately. This is how the state treats these children. And so I want to go back to this question of trauma. You know, Tim O'Brien wrote a book called The Things They Carry. And it was a story about the things that the soldiers, the grunts, the guys in Vietnam carried. They carried packs, 150-pound packs. They carried shovels. They carried radio equipment. They carried a rifle. They carried canteens. They carried rain equipment. They carried so much. And he talks about those things, and he keeps repeating them. But you know what the book is really about? It's about what they carried inside. It's about what we can't see. It's about trauma. And that's what these children live out and carry on their bodies. These marks of stigma that says you don't count. You're part of those who don't count. You're the excluded, the socially expendable. And these kids feel like garbage. And their mothers do what they can to give them back some pride, but the mothers have been stripped. The question is, as I tried to study children, of course I was forced to say, I have to study their mothers.
Yeah.
Because it's all they've got. And so I asked myself, who are these women? And what I came up with is that 2/3 of these women, we used to do workshops at Cook County Jail on domestic violence. We'd show films, we'd say to the women, we did this every 2 weeks for 6 years until they kicked us out. No one can get back in Cook County Jail now. Not even lawyers can get back. You know, there was that scandal. People think, you know, reforms, you just explode what it's like. Remember when the guards beat up guys, and then there was this big hullabaloo, and they went after the sheriff? Great. We showed them, right? Now no one can get in. They're not going to let anyone know. And in fact, they let some student lawyers in, and they said, you have to sign a form that says you will not bring any suits against Cook County Jail. If you don't sign it, you can't come in. Now, this sounds real illegal to me, but they did it. So I'm taking some time to say that that what I learned at this domestic violence workshop from these women is that at the end of the films, I'd say, can anybody relate to this? And practically every person in the room raised their hand. 2/3 of the women who are incarcerated have been victims of physical or sexual abuse. That's the crime that started their lives. And then often they medicate in their teenage years, trying to deal with the pain of that. Who are these women? 20% are homeless. Can you hear me? 20% are homeless, 23% are mentally ill, 2/3 have suffered abuse. The majority have no high school diploma. 50% were unemployed at the time of their arrest and incarceration. 1 in 5 were wards of the state. I have more of that, but just a sense of that. Now remember, they're in there for nonviolent crimes, and when they leave, the only anchor these kids have in the world is gone. I'd like to tell you the story about what some of the children told me, but I really want Winona to do that. And before she starts, I wanna just say, well, how grand is this problem? When I said that there'd been a 400% increase in the arrest of women, again, 70% of whom are mothers, I didn't tell you this statistic. Here's the percentage of African-American women that have been arrested between 1986, have been imprisoned, I'm sorry, between 1986 and 1991. I should say incarcerated, to be precise. It's 828% increase, which begins to make clear that this is a process of gendered racism. And the question is, how could they get away with it? I mean, even if it was poor white women, how could there be that kind of an increase? With these kids just cut adrift, how could it happen? Well, it has to be because there is an ability to have created images that started in slavery of the black mother as promiscuous, as Jezebel, as not competent, as, quote, an unfit mother. Those images are so virulent, and we've had them in this culture so long, they can just get picked up by any of the right that wants to say, here's America's moral crisis and it's because of them. This deflects us from looking at social inequity and poverty that's so massive and pervasive that it's become normative. We can blame it on these people that are seen as an abject failure. So these images are powerful, and everyone, in some ways, is affected by them. So that it's not simply the criminal justice system. There's ways in which all of us become allow this, or there'd be this hue and cry. So the last thing I want to say, and then it's going to be Winona's turn, is how did this all start? I'll be quick. It started with political space being captured by the right, which is to say, Reagan came to power, he passed the crime bill in 1984, in 1986, he passed the Anti-Drug Act. These two acts created mandatory minimum sentencing, which has gutted our prisons and jails. Highest prison rate of any country in the world, and growing. When Reagan did this, he created a situation whereby judges, even if they wanted to show some compassion or discretion, can't because of mandatory minimum. These are draconian laws. They've got to stay within those guidelines. Just before Reagan passed those bills, there were 500,000 people in prison. 4 years later, that had doubled. There were 1 million. In 2005, it's 2 million. That's the increase. That's what's happened to women. That's why they're being caught up in this net. She's going to tell you about why aren't there services, drug services. 80%, according to the Illinois Department of Corrections, 80% of the women need drug rehab and only 16% get it. That's according to the department. Why isn't there drug rehab? If Reagan had a war on drugs, first of all, it's sort of like the war on poverty. Poverty won, and now drugs have won. And the point is, these wars are part of, quote, reforms. And the reforms have to, the reforms are benefiting some and not others. Let me give you one other statistic. The differential The racial differential in terms of sentencing before Reagan was 6%. After Reagan, within 4 years, it was 93%. 93% people of color, they get a higher sentence than whites. The last thing I want to say about that drug act is probably what we never hear. Here's how much the war on drugs cost before Reagan. It cost $200 million. Now it costs $13 billion. Somebody's getting very, very rich off of imprisonment. It's called the prison industrial complex. And the prison industrial complex is one of our most profitable ventures in this country.